Welcome to the podcast dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. Today, we are going to answer the questions that you submitted. And one of the questions actually deals with maybe we're doing this whole thing wrong with glucose and fructose. It'll be interesting to look into. So it'd be a good one. You can submit those questions at trainerroad.com/podcast or on Spotify. You can just go to this episode right now that you're listening to, and Spotify allows you to enter your podcast question right there. And then we can go through and get your podcast questions directly from Spotify. One-stop shop. It's amazing. If you haven't, start listening to it on Spotify. It's fantastic. Or watch it on YouTube, because you can watch video the whole time while you're there. It's really great. Let's get into the first one. This is submitted by Paul. He says, with Red Bull recently announcing a majority stake in Bora Hansgrohe, that's the cycling team that now Primoz Roglic rides for, he just got hired for this year, what changes do you think they will or should do to optimize performance like they've done in Formula One on their way to being the most dominant team? It's like a dream budget, you know?
I was going to say, like, it's all about budget, money, but also the aerodynamics from F1. I wonder if there'll be more, like, you know, looking into that for the group and stuff. But I feel like it's been done so much to death. Like, is there, how many more, much more gains are there left on the table?
There's one that I have in mind, Nate, and I want your thought on this. So the UCI, we'll link down to the rule below, and I may, and correct me if I'm wrong on this. Okay. So if you're listening right now in the YouTube comments, correct me, let me know. But I believe that the UCI issued an update to the rules for TT bikes to make the extensions be more parallel to the ground, stop them from going so high angled upward. And as a result, there are a lot of athletes, because the whole point of, if you're, imagine a bike with me in my mind right now, in your mind, when you're in a TT position, don't jump into my mind, that's weird. But if you're in a TT position and you imagine that your forearms are parallel to the ground, you'll notice that that's not a position that a lot of people have these days. Back in the day, it was more common, but these days they're raising their, they're like hinging at the elbow and raising their arms upward. And then the whole point behind that is that it stops the air from rushing into your stomach, your chest and your stomach, because that's basically like a parachute. So if you can raise your arms up and get them closer to your chin, then that means that you can kind of close that off and give this kind of like add a point, like a snow plow, so to speak, from a truck, and the air can flow around you. And that's what they've done for years.
There's some arm pads that kind of help with that. I'm older, so like Levi Leipheimer, and you also call it turtling, where you're, it's kind of hard to look too. They're just barely like looking over their thumbs. That's how high their thumbs are, right below their eye line.
Yeah. And this has been a common approach. And it seems like what they're trying to do is stop that from happening. I don't know why.
Why?
I have no clue.
Handling, maybe? Like, maybe. I don't think there's ever been a crash like that way. No. That's not like, you know, wet or somebody running out.
Right.
I don't really crash on TT bikes.
No,
I mean, unless you're like...
You slide out in the rain. That's like the common thing that happens. And who cares where your hands are? You're going to slide out, right?
Yeah.
So they've changed that. And part of me wonders this now. What if teams... So let's assume that you can't get your wrists higher than your elbows, so to speak, are so high, at least. Maybe what you do then is you raise the front end of the bike so that it's just a lot higher, and then you kind of have your shoulders more shrugged. But then maybe, I know that there's a rule between like the top of the frame or the wheels and then the tips of the extensions and the pads. So I wonder if frames will start making really tall head tube and like really tall top tube TT bikes. Because if you think about it, you don't really need a low top tube for a TT bike. You get on the bike, you swing your leg over it, and then you go. And if it's uncomfortable to do so, who cares? Because once you're on the bike and pedaling, that's all that matters. I could see a world where you have like a really short seat post, so to speak, because your seat tube is so high and your top tube is actually really high off the ground. And you have this,
is my dream,
high head tube. And if you had that, I wonder if that could make it more aerodynamic. You kind of just lift everything up to get around this rule change.
But the drop wouldn't be there. They wouldn't have much of a drop. So like, so they'd be higher in general.
Yeah.
And then be less.
So the question then becomes like, is a flat back better? Even if, you know, you get your upper body a little bit higher, but is a flat back better? But I feel Red Bull can figure it out, right?
Yeah. I don't think it's that the turtling stuff isn't that much of a difference for people. Maybe like up to 10 watts where like a, you know, dropping would be more. I think is it money? Like just getting a better riders? Like how much would that, like Sky used to do that too, right? Just buy really good riders and have like their lieutenants be able to like win the Tour de France.
It's crazy, right?
But like instead they're riding for the winner. Yeah.
second and third string. In this case, they bought 51% of the team, reportedly. So that's an interesting, like, so that means that they didn't just come in and invest, but they want actual decision-making power in the team, which is interesting.
I wonder if that's going to change cycling in general, because what Red Bull wants is advertising and they want eyes on Red Bull. So I bet, I wonder if this will go through their channels more, their marketing channels, more cycling available in more places, which would be amazing for all of us to watch.
Yeah. And for them to be the ones making decisions and kind of like calling shots with that is really interesting, with them having that sort of majority. And who knows, they may still be deferring to team management and everything else. But the point is they could, since they are majority owners technically.
Yeah.
But you look back though, in 2004, when Red Bull bought that Jaguar F1 team, nobody was like, oh, this is going to revolutionize things. And in this case, Paul says they're the most dominant team. They've only been the most dominant team for the past 2 to 3 years now. Prior to that, it's been Mercedes and Lewis Hamilton forever, and they were dominant. So like, we might not see changes really add up to getting to the point of dominance for a really long time. I would assume that it's probably easier to make those sort of gains with a big budget in the cycling world. But man, like you said, Nate, just being able to afford all of the key riders would be huge. But then if they can figure stuff out with aerodynamics, if they are the ones that are like, because Sky had this brand of like, I mean, they had like separate washing machines for every rider's kits. They had towel, or they were bringing pillows and mattresses that were unique to every single hotel. And they were slicing and dicing every detail. And that was the brand of the team. And it's kind of been lost now. It's just like Ineos Grenadiers are good, but they're not dominant and doesn't seem, they don't have that brand. Even if they are, they don't have the brand of like searching every detail. But I feel like this opens the door for it, for Bora. Like they could be.
They can hire a pillow guy. Pillow person, scare pillows.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it'd be pretty impressive. I'm excited to see what it looks like. And also, I wonder how they'll brand the team. I know Nate's into soccer too, so maybe it's like the New York Red Bulls, or maybe they have everybody in Red Bull helmets and all their athletes are a big thing. So, could be interesting. So, okay, Ian's question says,
wait, what if they all do Rampage? Like, just kidding.
Big brand change.
Good. All of a sudden, like, just to.
You can imagine that in their contract, they're like hoping to race the tour. And then they also, the stipulation, they have to race the tour and do Rampage. So
that would be, for those who don't know, that is the most horrific, horrifying mountain bike, like I don't even, downhill in history. Like watch, Google like first person Red Bull Rampage footage. And like, I shake. You just see these
watching,
they go down. Jonathan gets sweats, which is insane.
Yeah. Can't imagine doing it. You know, Primoz Roglic was a ski jumper, though. So maybe, I don't know.
That's what they're pretty much doing in backflips on dirt.
It's nuts. Okay, Ian's question says, what's highly branched cyclic dextrin? And should I, it might be cyclic, I'm not sure on the pronunciation. And should I be using it instead of maltodextrin for carbohydrate in my bottles? Ian answers, in Canada, or Ian goes on to say, in Canada, it's about 4 times more expensive than maltodextrin. Thanks. Which is, that's crazy. And a lot of people make their own drink mixes these days by buying something like maltodextrin, dextrose, and then buying fructose, and then you mix them together. And then based on that, you go, some people just mix table sugar, which I think is a terrible idea. It's not very well refined or cleaned. Doesn't mix well at all. I don't know how you'd mix it. You'd have to have like boiling water.
Messed our stomach up. Yeah. You got to like make a simple syrup. We tried that once and it was like gas city.
No, it was terrible. So
bad.
But people make their own drink mixes, and Scratch actually has their super carb mix. And in that super carb mix, they actually have a cluster dextrin, which effectively cyclic dextrin, highly branched cyclic dextrin. Another word for it would be a cluster dextrin. I'm going to kind of like explain the inner workings of this, Nate, then maybe we can like jive on how all this works and how like it could be beneficial for us athletes. But there's some interesting stuff here. So effectively, I'm going to break down carbs, and I'm not a chemist, so I'm probably going to screw this up, y'all. I was terrible in chemistry, but just the same, we're going to go through it. First, all this stuff starts with starches, and those naturally occur in tons of different carbohydrates and food sources. So they're composed of two molecules, amylose and amylopectin. And those two different things have unique characters. We'll get into those in just a second here. But from those different things, you can break them down in a process called hydrolysis. And that's when you get things like this cyclic dextrin that we're talking about, or maltodextrin, or dextrose, or even all the way down to glucose. Okay. So it all starts with starches. Now, like I mentioned, there's that amylose thing. And bring your brain back to chemistry here. And whenever we draw out elements or different things like this, different compounds, we see that they have this structure where different things are linked together, right? And in this case, when you're talking about amylose, it's a, like a linear chain of glucose that's put together. And in one respect, it allows them to like branch out a little bit, but it's more or less a linear chain. But amylopectin, the other part of starches, is highly branched. Imagine a tree that just has branches going all over the place. And at the end of every branch starts a new branch that can go into a bunch of different branches. So that is where this highly cyclic, or this cyclic dextrin or cluster dextrin comes from, because what it does is it's this complex structure that allows on that chain a ton of different little nodes where glucose can exist, okay? Versus a very simple chain. And the process, and they're broken down. Maltodextrin is one that is taken down through the process of what's called partial hydrolysis, and it results in shorter chains of glucose that are put together. Whereas HBCD, I'm just going to say that instead of cyclic dextrin because I'll mess that up, that is just this crazy complex longer chain. Now, what that ends up happening, or what that ends up delivering for athletes, is that it makes it so that it dissolves and I guess is digested a lot slower in the gut. And in fact, it passes through the gut and then is dissolved later on and processed through your body. And all of the breakdown of cyclic dextrin like this happens, it's a bit in the stomach, but mostly in the small intestine, okay? So here's what that would give you as an athlete. That would make it slower to digest and absorb. It would also theoretically mean that you would have a more consistent and slower release of energy. It also has lower osmolality, which basically means that it doesn't require as much water in that process. So it's not going to bring a ton of water to your gut and cause you to get an upset stomach. All these things sound really good, and it seems like a good idea, but we have to sit back and ask ourselves a few key things. Number one, think of this like a business. When your expenses exceed your revenue, which basically you're burning more than you can actually take in on the bike, is it a good idea to have these like these assets that you're getting, like these slowly maturing assets like bonds? No, you want something that's going to give you cash now, right? So then that way, what you can do is you can pay things off. And this theory of like the fact that slower release energy is more beneficial for us, it all operates on this flawed premise that actually is beneficial. In reality, if you're burning a ton, you want stuff that burns pretty darn fast, and you want to be taking it in very often. And this is interesting. Dr. Alex Hutchinson on our the Trainer Road forum posted a fantastic thing about this, and he mentioned the fact that it's really not better to have slower releasing. Instead, increase your rate at which you're taking in these glucose drinks, and then just make sure that you're taking in the fastest burning that you can. And in most cases, it's actually going to lead to less stomach distress that you would have. So it's an interesting concept, and it could work, but here's why these cluster dextrins aren't necessary and you don't have to spend so much money on them. In most cases, you're mixing glucose and fructose. Glucose is very simple. It's broken down really quickly. Fructose takes longer, goes through the liver. And in that very system right there, in that drink, you kind of have both sides covered, quick energy and longer lasting energy that you could have coming through that. So if you're mixing something like cluster dextrin with fructose, you're likely getting something that's going to digest a lot slower. And in some cases, that's going to cause you to take in too much because you're trying to get that hit of energy. And then you might get to the point where it's like, shoots, now my gut is blown up because I've taken in 120 grams and I'm not used to that. Or you'll be taking it in slowly and you'll just have a slow burn, but you'll lack that faster hitting energy. So ingredients do matter. You could say that like cluster dextrin is no different than a lot of different other things. And effectively, it's probably not going to make some massive difference for you. It's very similar to what you'd find. But in my case, I've tried cluster dextrin before. I found that it gave me personally really low amounts of energy. I didn't feel like I got a good hit from it. And I always got an upset stomach from it versus glucose, which you'd think might give you more of an upset stomach. And I just use pure glucose for my stuff. But it's kind of interesting, right, Nate? Like this whole concept of slower energy is better, or slower release. But in theory, you know.
Yeah, I think it's people who are concerned about like the insulin model of like if your insulin spikes too much, you're going to get fat, which I think has been proven wrong. And I'm going to get hate for that. And please just put all the comments in the YouTube. So there's an argument. And we'll get a lot of stuff. People will show it. But so I think another idea is that it's not going to upset your stomach as much. That's what I think. And
yeah,
I saw that alone, maybe try it, but I looked here too. I'm looking at studies for it, and this is so key. It was one article that I was reading on a sports nutrition, like they're selling the drink, said that it improved performance. Then you read the actual article, and there were no significantly difference between the trials. So there's like one was slightly increased, but it was not statistically significant. And then on the page, though, if you didn't jump in, it says that it actually helped, which are, I don't even, they even measure like speed in this. They just measured like markers.
Yeah.
I am one to try everything new, and I do try everything new, and placebo does work too. And maltodextrin, if you buy it in bulk, it's like $10 for a few pounds, right? Like it can last you months and months and months. And if it's $40, that's going to last you months and months, maybe. I don't know. I don't see any harm in trying it, but I wouldn't break the bank or think that I'm not doing well if I don't have it too.
Yeah. I could see this working if you don't have a high carb intake rate. Like think back to back in the day when people would take in like 20 grams of like from a gel and they would take that in once an hour and then that would be it. In this case, this might give you like longer lasting. You might experience a bit less peak and valley with energy.
Yeah.
But carb if you're loading? Taking in, yeah, that could work too.
Yeah. Like during the day, drink mm-hmm. some. So you get kind of like sustained throughout the day.
It'd be better than just sipping on glucose, right? Which is likely going to spike and cause that sort of thing. And really, if you're taking in 90 or 120 grams an hour, it's kind of like a high traffic scenario anyway. So you really want that stuff, the cars to get through the freeway quickly. You don't want it to go slow on the freeway. Like you want it to pass yeah. through and give you that energy fast, you know? But I've never tried Scratch's mix, to be fair. I haven't tried their mix, and I'd be interested to try that because they partner it with fructose, and it'd be cool to see how it works. But I've just purchased it in bulk before, and yeah. I found the best result for me is just pure glucose. It's expensive. It's not like the whole process that we were talking about earlier here where we were talking about hydrolysis. Like hydrolysis, the process to create glucose, it has to be really pure and really refined. And after it goes through hydrolysis, they have to clean it again. And then you get like a really refined and pure substance that you're putting into your body.
Sounds like you're talking about drugs.
No, it does, right? Yeah.
Someone's cooking here. Yeah.
And narcos. Yeah. But when you look at something like maltodextrin, it doesn't have to go through such a thorough process. And that's why it's cheaper. Now, when you create this HBCD stuff, it's like a very unique process. It's very costly. It's hard to get right. That's why it costs so much more, like so much more money. Even though it goes through less refining processes that something like glucose does, it's a proprietary, it's like a unique process that it goes through that's much more difficult to manage and create at scale. Whereas maltodextrin is pretty darn easy to create, and that's why it's so cheap. You know, you might get just as much benefit from taking in maltodextrin than you would get from something like this. And it's just way cheaper and just a more, you know, an easy get. Like you can get dextrose at Walmart, right? It's just Gatorade powder. It's like really easy. So accessibility can be super important for athletes too. But in the end, I swear by pure glucose and then pure fructose. It mixes the easiest too, which is something cool that I found. Like I just put it in and I shake my bottle like three times and it's done and it's mixed and I never have to worry about it. And it's amazing. And I'm not having to put in like a little blender into my bottle or put it in a blender bottle, then pour it back into something else. It's so easy. It's like all those little details add up. And when it's a pain to ride your bike because you have to mix things and do all that every time, ugh. Sometimes it's enough to stop me from training. So yeah. Anyways, that's the skinny right now on that. And actually, go onto the forum. I'm going to link to that forum thread because somebody actually asked about this also on the forum thread. And Dr. Alex Hutchinson, you provide fantastic information on the forum. Always great. So go check that out. And I really appreciate all of your input on the forum. It's really good. So, okay. Freya's question says, my question is around training plans for people that don't race. How necessary is the specialty phase of the plan if I don't race? And will the specialty phase help make me faster? Or am I better off just going back into base and build again? I used Plan Builder for my training plan. Some background on Freya. Love Trainer Road and have been using it for the past year after following a training plan I found on Training Peaks. I use Trainer Road to get fitter and faster on the road. And I love feeling and being fast as I'm always underestimated while out cycling. Thanks for the podcast for Trainer Road service and all that you do. Yeah, that's the question there from Freya about specialty phase, Nate.
Well, yeah, if you plan not to race, you might want to do like the gravel plan or something like that. And that is probably how you're riding, like gravel, Century, Gran Fondo. you're just kind of riding without spikes and stuff like that. But the it's I remember that study where they took people and they did like it was just threshold or VO2 max intervals, and they did it like almost every day for like 6 weeks, and they had incredible amount of like 30 watts gained at FTP, but zero people wanted to continue again. And the nice thing about they said, who wants to try it again? And everyone said no. And the cool thing about specialty is it adds more variety to your training, where very interesting, the intervals change and they're usually like a lot shorter, besides maybe like I just said, Grand Fondo. Even like going to crit, it can help prevent burnout and raise interest. And also that like hitting those, that VO2 max just a little bit differently in anaerobic could actually make you faster also. Just building, you know, stronger legs and stuff like that. So I would do it and not be concerned about going back and forth, unless you say, I don't like specialty. I hate this kind of training. Then I would just skip it. Yeah.
Yeah. And Freya mentions that I love feeling and being fast, and I never feel faster than in the specialty phase. Because what's happening, Freya, is you have this chronic training load adding up. And over time, you just continue from base to build to specialty. Through base and build, you're adding up a lot of that chronic training load intentionally. You're dosing yourself with a little bit more every week. You offset it with a recovery week here and there. But as a whole, you start to accumulate more. If you look at like a time scale of how much training load did I do over the past 4 months, you'll see that the past 4 months are probably higher than the 4 months previous because you were in base and build. So what specialty does is it starts to drop that down. And when it drops that down, it allows your body to feel like it's refreshed, like wakes up on a sunny morning and it doesn't have this cloud of fatigue hanging over it. And then you're able to express a lot of the fitness that you have. It's interesting. A lot of the time you might actually have like all the fitness and all of the theoretical capability to be able to do something. But just because you don't, you're constantly training and you're carrying this level of fatigue, you can't express it.
You're so flat.
Yep, exactly. And that's what's cool about the specialty phase. And it also, that decrease, again, in training load that you experienced in the specialty phase makes it so that you can start another base or build and move on in your training with a little bit less training load on you recently in your training. And so it makes it so you can kind of stair step your way up. So I feel like for everybody, it's, like Nate said, for novelty and fun, it's cool to do something different. And then it also just gives you a better chance at being able to get more improvement after that. You know,
it's like the reward, you know, like you've worked all this time and then you get to like get out there and going on the, especially riding with friends, those little short, like 1 or 2 minute hills that people kick, you know, and then you're in specialty and you're just like, bam, 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 bam. You get to drop people. That's fun.
Yeah.
I did that once to Jonathan. I remember that day.
Yeah, it was a good day. I mean, for you. Yeah, not for me. Freya, something else too. If other people are listening to this and they're in Freya's position, let's say that you don't have like an event you're training for, you can do the weirdest specialty phase, right? Like if you're a gravel sort of athlete, but you want to do cyclocross, not because you're going to cyclocross race, but because you want to feel what it's like to be able to punch over and over and over. Do it, right? Like you don't have anything to lose. It's not like you have a race result that's depending on it. And it's really fun to, if you don't have race events, to go through and maybe this time you're going to do 40 KTT and you're just going to work on being a stable power beast. And then next time you're going to work on criterium or cross country short track or something totally unique. It's kind of fun to be able to play around with your fitness like that and experience something different. If you don't have goals, you might as well. And the cool part about that too, is I found that some things tend to kind of stick with you. I don't know if you found that, Nate, but from our time when we focused on time trials for a while, that really helped me learn how to put out stable power and how to manage that effort mentally. And that stuck with me. Like, even though I haven't been training like a time trialist, I can do steady efforts really well. And I used to not be able to. So it's kind of a cool way to like, you know, put something, broaden yourself out.
Teach you can suffer a lot more too. I'm thinking of VO2 max float sets where you go like 120 for like 15 seconds, and then you are at like 88 or something for 15 seconds. And you're just like, oh, no, I can't do another. I can't do another. But somehow 3 seconds before you're okay. and that's great when, especially when riding with groups too, a group ride where you don't think you can hang on. Cause they always slow down like 100 feet after you stop. Mm-hmm. And then you can't catch them because you're still like not there, you know, and or there's a draft or something like that. That's the worst.
The dangle's the worst. Yeah, absolutely. So Freya, again, recapping, it's not necessarily better to go into base and build again. In fact, if you're just looking at like, where will you be at the end of the year and you have the opportunity to skip a specialty phase and instead just do base and build and repeat that until the end of the year or have a specialty. I actually bet you would get faster if you had a specialty phase in there by the end of the year, because it would allow you to shed that fatigue, make training more interesting, and allow you to be more consistent with it too. That's like a, that's an interesting point, Nate, on novelty. Can we talk about that for a little bit? Because when we design our training plans, and any good coach, I mean, a coach that's like really going through and analyzing and picking and creating specific workouts for you as an athlete, that sort of thing, they are taking novelty into account. I think there's a lot of people that might feel bad about the fact that they're just making it fun and entertaining for me. You should not feel bad about that. If you're higher or more highly motivated in your training, my goodness, you're going to perform those workouts so much better. You're going to look forward to your next workout after that. There's a huge part in it. Like, the psychological aspect of this is just huge. So, and that's something we consider in our training and workout alternates too. Man, if you feel like you're lacking novelty, just use alternates and you can pick a different type of stimulus within that zone. It's just amazing for it. So, yeah.
So we have 4,500 structured workouts on our site.
Yeah, it's crazy, huh? Yeah, it's a lot. Okay, Grant says, I'm on the high volume, full distance triathlon plan and the build phase is due to begin. That's a lot of work. High volume, full distance triathlon. I did like low volume for a half distance triathlon. Grant's impressive. I can't imagine. Like, it's just so hard. Like, cyclists listening to this, training for three different sports like that, it's really, really, really tough. So I've had success throughout the base phase, and on a recent outdoor long group ride, I'm happy to say I was flying up the long climbs without really pushing myself. Nevertheless, the base phase gave me some long 2-hour runs, which I enjoyed, but the build phase steps up to over 2-hour runs, and I wondered if doing these on the trails would prove more beneficial than pounding on the road. Thanks from Preston, Lancashire, UK, from Grant. Nate, did you do this when you did try training, Nate?
Yeah, the thing you got to be careful with on trail is it like hilly at all? Because it's the downhills that'll kill your knees. But in the UK, it's like pretty flat there. So I don't know if, I mean, definitely if you have a choice between asphalt and concrete around the asphalt, I mean, you're starting to get hit by a car. And then if you have a choice between that and like dirt around the dirt, because it's just going to be a little bit softer. And I don't know if there's a, this is like, what's it called? Conventional wisdom with runners passed down. I don't know if it's actually true, but I like to run on, I don't know, it feels good to run on dirt and you get like run in nature rather than on the road.
So I looked into this with studies because I've always heard the same thing. But then I find myself, Nate, like running on these super shoes with like 2.5 inches of foam. And you're like, is there really any difference between concrete
and you're like, totally right.
soft sand, right?
With a carbon plate that's bouncing you up, like.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, what's the difference?
With modern shoes, there's probably no difference. And I looked at different, and actually research, they don't indicate that they were running with super shoes. They just indicate that they were running. So I have no clue if they were using them or not. But there are some studies that have said yes, that have pointed to the fact that yes, there is more impact. And they've measured impact and strain on the tibia, typically is where they measure it in these studies. But then there's effectively like the same study carried out by different people. And there are multiple instances of this. One that I can give out, I'll put a link down below, is Garcia from 2021 and colleagues. They put one out where they found no difference between running on like gravel, like a dirt path, and then running on pavement and running on different surfaces. So, but here's the interesting thing is that when you run, and actually this is kind of counterintuitive, but when you run on a softer surface, we actually tend to land harder, or we stiffen up our legs more. And that's because we're landing on a more unstable surface. So we actually stiffen up our legs more is what they found. There's greater muscle contraction and less movement in the joint when you run on a softer surface. Whereas on the road, our body kind of adapts to that. And it's like, oh, this is not changing. This is not giving underneath me. Therefore, I will adjust and I'll actually land a bit softer when I run. But that doesn't necessarily mean that one is more or less damaging on your body. The big thing is when you run on pavement or on asphalt, cement, it's almost always the same stroke. You never have to change the way that you're stepping. You never have to change the angle at which you're landing. So there's a theory out there amongst a lot of people that if you are going to run, running on trail can be beneficial just because it has you landing and stepping differently in every step versus doing the same thing over and over and over. And if your soft tissue isn't prepared, or even your bones, they're not prepared for something like that, theoretically, it could be easier to get an overuse injury if you're doing the same exact thing over and over versus having different stride lengths, different lateral moves, different push-off points, all that stuff that you would get with a trail.
Squishy thing I'd like to see with like a treadmill, because treadmill has it really easy to have a whole bunch of like squish on it. And out of my experience, treadmill has been much easier not to be injured. This is anecdotal. It doesn't mean anything at all. So
yeah,
don't mean that, but yeah.
Yeah,
I do the trail, like, Grant. Yeah.
Trail, and also cyclists are probably listening to this. And I think the trail running, the tricky part is you have to, like Nate said, you have to watch out for steep hills, rolling your ankle. And chances are for your cyclist, you have super weak feet and ankles, which means you're probably going to roll your ankle pretty easily. But I think that it's probably going to be a lot more beneficial than just running on a road, because we totally lack all of that lateral support and the movement that we get when we are trail running. When you're on a bike, you're just operating in that single plane. And when you run, you also operate in that single plane. It's more dynamic, but still that single plane. But trail running, it works you way, way better. So I think it'd be better for most people if they did trail stuff. You know?
I think of like in the UK in the winter, just running on like wet leaves and through mud on the trail.
Oy.
Like, yeah.
Terrifying. And
there are those trails like, you know, in parks that are kind of flat. Then there's like trail where you are like up and down. I would not have that be your, unless you're an exterior athlete, I would not have that replace your 2 hour run.
Yeah.
Especially for 2 hours.
Nate said this could be conventional wisdom, but I know Paula Finley and Eric Lagerstrom, they're friends of mine, professional triathletes, very famous professional triathletes. They run on trail a ton. So, and they like to do it because of the fact that it's softer, but I think it's also a bit more just dynamic and interesting to them because they train so much. They're always doing mm-hmm. running and everything else. And trails are a whole lot more interesting for them, but they do a lot of it. Certain athletes I'd be surprised to see. And maybe if you're a triathlete listening to this, we can put a poll up right now on Spotify. If you go to that and you can fill out the poll, it'd be really interesting to see if you do run, triathlete or not, if you do run, do you spend more time on the road or more time on the trails? Because I bet it's more time on the road for the majority of us. But trails, I think, if it's especially it's cross training, would actually be more beneficial for us. So yeah, it'd be interesting. But yeah, anyways, the myth is kind of debunked by science that, and especially these darn super shoes. I can't tell if I'm landing on a pebble or a rock, you know.
Right, you can't even feel a rock. Yeah.
No, you can't. It's all squished. So it's amazing. Okay, Johannes says, while watching the World Cup cyclocross events, I'm noticing how much more dominant these athletes are who are multidisciplinary. Why are we not seeing more road cyclists try cyclocross or mountain biking? It seems very effective for Puck Petersy. And for those that don't know, Puck, she is the overall World Cup mountain bike champion last year, which is super impressive. But she's primarily a cyclocross racer. And she also races on the road, and she does great in all disciplines, but she does all of them. Then Matthew Vanderpoel, Wout van Aert, and Tom Pidcock, and most of us know who they are and how dominant they are. And especially this year, Vanderpoel is just like a step above absolutely everybody. And it seems like he could be riding with his brakes on and still win. So yeah, why are we not seeing more road cyclists try cyclocross or mountain bike?
It's pretty easy. That's because it's like technical skills. You don't have it as a road cyclist. You can go the other way, cyclocross to mountain bike to road, but not road to mountain bike or cyclocross.
Yeah.
Like, at all.
No, you see, and we see that too. Some road racers try cyclocross and stuff, and despite the bad call-up positions that they move backward. They do not move up, even though they have huge thresholds and that sort of thing. It's also really easy to get hurt doing training for something like this. Like you crash a lot on cyclocross. Granted, the crashes don't hurt, relatively speaking, compared to road. You're less likely to get damaged per crash, but you still crash a lot. And if you're a cyclist with just roadie with bird bones, you know, tipping over and hitting your shoulder can cause a shoulder separation or a collarbone break. And then that's in the middle of the winter. So then you're not going to hit peak form again for these athletes until late in the summer. It's a huge amount riding on them. But all that said, I guarantee you they would be better for it if they worked on more of their skills, you know?
I think part of it too is the, like the survivor bias is that you see the top athletes in cyclocross move over because there's more money. And so you focus on those people. But imagine if there was less money in road and the top and skills didn't matter, right? Because skills don't matter going from cyclocross to road. Like it's not as, mm-hmm. they matter a little bit, but they're not as impactful the other way. That you just took the top four road cyclists and moved them over to cyclocross and say they had equal skills. You'd be like, oh my gosh, everyone should be road cycling because they're like cleaning up. This is crazy. Because that's all you have too, right? Let's just the top contenders, because the lower contenders can't make that move. or they don't make that move because they know they're, you know, it's not going to be a good move at all. I think that's what you might be seeing here too. Although you have like MVDP, like B, Matthew Vanderpool, amazing and, you know, like generational. That's yeah.
You guys amazing.
That's a little different. Yeah.
Did you notice that you were a better road racer or, after doing cyclocross?
No. Yeah. I don't think cyclocross had, helped at all on anything. It was just fun and scary at the same time.
And I think that's like, we're looking at like really rare athletes. Like Puck is also like generational and wow. And Tom, they're all like, we're looking at the tip of the spear, like Nate said. So these athletes can go over and do something like this, and it is fun for them because they're so comfortable doing it, and they have that sort of level of skill. Most people probably wouldn't get that much benefit from it. The other reason that we should talk about is Matthew and Wow and Tom have all said, and I'm not sure, I haven't seen it from Puck, but I would assume that she would. They say it's really hard to get that level of intensity in an hour in training, is what they say. They're like, in a race environment, it's easier for them to go super deep for that 45 minutes to an hour. And they feel like that's beneficial for their training. That's another aspect of it too, right? You put a road cyclist into that situation, they might not be able to push that hard because they're so panicked and just trying to figure out their skills too. They might not get the same benefit.
You know? Your heart rate gets just as high. You're not going as fast. Yeah. Not getting the fitness from it too.
Right. But aside from all this, if you look at these athletes and you look at everything that they're putting into it, we've talked about racing in the base phase before and how it's good. Like, don't feel like you can't race in the base phase. And you want to make sure that you're planning it and giving padding around that. So if you mark it as like a B race in your calendar, adaptive training is going to adjust for that. Working on some new features right now that are really exciting that are going to look at efforts like this and make additional adjustments, even more adjustments, and improve your training even further than what it is right now at Trainer Road, which will be really cool. But you want to make sure that you're spacing it out. But these athletes are racing relatively early on in their year, and it isn't burning them out. It isn't blowing them up. That really old thought process that you like can't break Z2 for the whole entire base phase, and then later on you can, is disproven by these athletes and by tons of other athletes. I think that they're showing that you can go super deep and have fun in these sort of races and do that sort of thing. And as long as you're not doing too much of it, and as long as you are planning space around that sort of thing, then it can be really beneficial, you know? So don't worry about racing in the base phase, I guess, is the message, the other message that I get from it. So Nate, have you watched any cross races this year? I don't know if you have.
No, I haven't.
Vanderpool, it's weird seeing how much better he is this year. And it just looks like, and I would be so curious to see what his FTP is this year. Like, I know he's used Trainer Road before, but we don't snoop accounts. We don't do that sort of thing. but I'd be really curious to see what his FTP is this year, because it just looks like he's got 50 watts on everybody. And the reason that I say that is he goes through the sand. He isn't laboring like he has had to in previous years. Compared to everybody else, he looks calm. Like, he's able to make it up certain obstacles that other people simply can't. And it's because he's able to carry and hold momentum through it like I've never seen. His surges out of corners, he's staying seated more often than he was before. And he's still gapping everybody when he's surging out of turns. It's like, it's different. He almost looks bigger too. Like, maybe not as lean. Like, he has like more to him, maybe more muscle mass. I don't know. It's quite interesting, but it's an entirely different level this year.
That could be, that could have a higher FTP because of that and be better through sand would make sense. A little heavier rider, higher FTP, raw watts. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good example of being heavier, being better off. So, Tim says, when you set up your plan, does it make much difference to the adaptations you'll get if you move the days around and don't do them as set up by the plan? For example, if you have threshold Monday and endurance Wednesday, but you weren't feeling it on Monday, so you did the endurance and moved the threshold to Wednesday instead. I've always wondered if that will change the adaptations if you move them about, or if you move them around, as there might be sweet spot on Friday, so having endurance on Wednesday. All this is confusing to read out, but he's basically asking, if I move around my workouts, is that going to give me different adaptations throughout the week?
Not at the moment, but I was in something today that it will in the future do that. So that's something we're working on, but at the moment it won't update your adaptations.
And then talking about training adaptations in terms of like maybe that, and you could be asking about adaptations with, it sounds like with Trainer Road, but on the training adaptation side of doing your threshold earlier in the week and then doing something else like that. It really depends, right? Like Nate, we've talked about stacking before.
And yeah, because if you don't have, if you're not the endurance ride is there, so you can partially recover so you can hit your threshold ride hard. And I should have said that too. It will impact your adaptations if you then don't hit the workout like you are. It was prescribed, then it will. And so I mean, if you had all the intense days all in a row, and then all the endurance days on other days of. I think we could all know that it would impact your training in a negative manner. That's what we have days between hard days. But at the moment it won't, unless you perform differently, it won't change the next week. But then, like I said, we're working on it.
This is purely anecdotal, but it's from people that I see like on the forum. If there's an athlete that says that like, I'm burnt out, Trainer Row burnt me out or something like that on the forum, I go on there and we have an awesome team on there, Kato, Eddie, and Zach, and they're always looking into this stuff. It's quite common in situations like that. Almost always these athletes are doing too much. That's almost always like there's the plan, but the plan is like 20 to 30% of what they're doing. It's all the other 70% of the stuff that's driving what's going on, yet they focus on the 20 to 30%. But in these situations, it's very common to see them doing back-to-back hard workouts, meaning like on Monday, I do my hard workout. On Tuesday, I do a hard workout. On Wednesday, I do a race. And then, you've had 3 days in a row where you do that. And maybe to add a visual to this, you want to go into a workout with like your batteries at a sort of level where you can get a lot of drain out of those batteries, right? If you go in there with already depleted because you've drained your batteries of the previous day's workout, you're simply not going to be able to go deep enough in that workout to make the sort of potential training adaptations that could happen to your body. Like the training only happens when you go to where your limits are or around your limits, right? And you spend time there to go past those limits. That's the whole point of like progressive overload, is that it gets a little bit more tough. If you're nerfing yourself by making yourself fatigued every time you come into those hard workouts, you can't do progressive overload because you can't progressively load yourself with more. You have to actually like progressively load yourself with less every single time you go into a workout. So I try to space them out as much as possible in terms of harder days. And that might be something that, whatever it might be, threshold, VO2 max, anaerobic, or whatever else it might be. Just try to space them out as much as you can in your week. And if you can, between those, if you have like a day off, really try to make sure that you schedule a day off in between those hard workouts. If you're doing a high volume plan, that might be tough, but if you're doing mid or low volume, it's certainly possible. And that's like what I've found to be the best, most helpful.
The other thing I see from that feedback is people will be doing like 2 or 250 TSS rides like in the weekend, or maybe two in a row. And they've always done that looking back at the career. But then when you add actual structure to that also, it needs to something needs to move. Or you need to adapt to that over time. And for red light, green light, we're like doing the bugging, and we're looking at, people have complained that like Trainer has burnt them out. If this would have like gave them a notice. And I'm not saying in this case too, that we burnt them out. I'm saying it's the adding of it's the combining of the outside huge rides with the structured training. Those outside huge rides can, sometimes count for double a normal ride, even though they're not intense, just the amount of TSS and strain they put on you. You need to recover from that before you can start a hard ride again, which, as you said, your battery has to fill up again so you can drain it. And so far it has. So that would be, I was like, ooh, that would prevent, as long as they listen to it, but at least you could see on the calendar of like, oh, there's some yellow and red days. It's saying, watch out. Maybe I should skip this day, or it gives an adaptation to give a rest. So if you do those long rides, it would impact the structured rides, right? Mm-hmm. Or it could warn you ahead of time, on that long ride of day, like, hey, this is a caution day. You might want to do something short, not a big, long ride today.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like red light, green light. It protects us from ourselves, right, Nate? Like us, like protects the athlete from themselves, because we more often think that like our eyes are bigger than our stomachs and we bite off more than we can chew. And we think that it's totally fine. And we think it's totally fine. And we don't find out that it's a problem until we've gotten ourselves into a hole. And this proactively handles that.
I had that video of that I looked at your account, and like you got sick afterwards. The same thing happened to my account. Like I had red days and it's sick. Or it's like getting tired from training in my notes. And then it's like yellow, red, and I'm like training through it. And then it's like, let's have a sinus infection again.
Yeah.
It'd be cool. Weird. To like use. Yeah. If everyone had notes, a lot of people don't put notes in like that, but it'd be cool to be able to like correlate those two of how often do people say something, they're overtraining, they keep going, and then suddenly they stop training like suddenly. And two, it's motivated. Sometimes too, you don't get sick. You just are like, I don't want to train this week. You suddenly get too busy.
Yeah. You know, one other way that'll be cool that I think athletes will be using red light, green light is when they have a red day or something else. To your point in this question here, what you might do is you might decide to push Tuesday's hard workout to Thursday. You can just drag and drop it on your calendar if you want. You can move it around. Like, we give you all those tools so that you can make those adjustments too if you need to. But that might be cool. Like if you're like, oh, I'm on a yellow day, so I'm going to just decide that today is going to, I'm going to swap that endurance workout for something, my harder scheduled workout. I'm going to move that a little further away from this yellow day, and it's going to make it a little bit easier.
Well, and we'll suggest it too. If you're on a train or road plan, we'll suggest changing those. I don't know if I remember I said this, but I'll say it here too. Red Light Green Light uses workout levels V2 in the back end. I think I said this, but I'll just say it again. So
it's worth
it does,
explaining. Yeah.
Yeah. So workout levels V2, instead of just having one level scored in a workout indoors only, it scores all your training zones, and it does it for outdoor rides too. And that's, we use that to order to calculate how hard this ride is and how much it's harder it's been from other rides. Cause TSS doesn't unfortunately tell the whole story. You can have an hour at threshold, or you can have, 6-10 minute intervals at threshold, and they're pretty much going to be the same TSS, which is crazy to think about. One's a lot easier to recover from the other. And then relative to where your fitness is, one could be, the hour could still be pretty easy if you did it before, or it could be the hardest effort you've ever done, and the recovery time on that will be different too. So that's why we're using that. That's a really good sign for the future that it's being used for this, but also it's not fine grain enough to be able to use for scheduling your next workout then of, should you get a 4.2 threshold or a 4.4 threshold, which can be a good RPE difference between those two. You can really feel that. But it is big enough to know that it's kind of like a more macro approach and more, we have a wider target to hit. So it doesn't have to be as accurate as we make that more refined and work better.
Yeah. Nate, I leaked actually workout levels V2 via Instagram last week. I didn't realize. I shared a screenshot of a ride and then I went to bed and then woke up the next morning. A lot of people were like, what's that? You know, because they saw it and I took it down, which I guess probably didn't have to. We talk about it on here too. But the biggest thing that I've noticed with that is that when I go out and do those endurance rides, just big rides with friends, Nate, everyone thinks they're doing an endurance ride, and it shows the fact that you're actually not doing an endurance ride. That's the most like common thing that I show my, like, turns out that I'm spending too much time in tempo, right? When I should be riding easier than that. Like, I think it's going to be really informative for a ton of athletes and help them turn down the intensity on those days. So then that way it allows them to push harder in the days that really matter, and make sure that they aren't cooking themselves coming into it. But it's super informative. It's going to change how people train.
You might think like time and zone is enough for that. Maybe tempo is the wrong one for it. Maybe like threshold. Cause over like a 2-hour ride, you're like, I got 25 minutes in threshold on all these little, you can get them different ways. And it might feel like you didn't do any threshold, or maybe you sprinted up the hills a few times with your friends. That can really bump up your level in that zone, and thus cause more recovery time, especially if you're pushing yourself past your limits. Combine that with the big endurance. You got to combine those two things, and that then impacts what your training is going to be. And that's I think that's those secret little things that you do the whole ride. And we get the question too, if I do that, will it ruin my endurance ride? It won't, but it will impact. If you keep doing enough, it'll impact. And this is just a way to measure it, which is the cool part.
Yeah, that compounding part is what this does unique. It's not just time and zone. It understands the relative context of, okay, so they did these little threshold efforts, but they did it amidst this huge ride. And as a result, this is the actual toll, right? This is the actual training effect from it, and the fatigue that they have needs some adjustment, needs to be made. So it's super exciting. I'm excited for our athletes to be able to use it.
I know. I'm sorry it's taking so long, but the first, you'll see red light, green light first, hopefully soon. I know it's on my calendar. We're checking people's stuff. we're making adjustments to it, but you know, it's that get to the very final part and you try to fix something and then something else moves. But this is, we really are. This is not like we're like, or we're as LV2. This is very close. And the front end, I think, is done on it. We actually released it accidentally for a second in the desktop app. Yeah. So somebody saw it for a little bit and then we rolled it back. That's how close. That's how close it is.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody probably looked at it and saw how many yellow and red days they had, right? So,
yeah.
Okay, this is the last question from Mark that we're going to cover this week. It's going to be a shorter episode than normal. If you've appreciated this episode, Nate and I are covering a bunch. If you appreciate it, go to Trainer Road and sign up. That's the best way that you can show appreciation for this. Share the podcast with your friends. If you've already signed up, share Trainer Road with your friends. You can review the podcast on Spotify, and you can submit your questions on Spotify. It's super easy, or you can do it at trainerroad.com/podcast. Okay, Mark says, big podcast fan and Trainer Road subscriber, 5 stars on every platform by default. Thank you, Mark. If you haven't rated recently on Spotify, I had somebody tell me this week that they find that they rate Spotify, and then like a month later, they can rate it again. I mean, it'd be great if you could help us, because it looks at like a rolling average of how many reviews you've gotten recently in terms of when it suggests our podcast to somebody when they're searching for a cycling podcast. So a steady flow is great. So if you haven't done it recently, go check to see if you can do it again. I've recently returned to school to obtain a graduate degree at the age of 44, and in an effort to maintain fitness but not compromise study time, I've been doing easy rides while studying case studies and research papers. Most of the material is business focused, and as a business owner, it's quite interesting and engaging for me, so perhaps that's the difference. But I've noticed it is much easier to retain knowledge for me in this recent re-entry into college than it was in my undergrad. Maybe it was the partying and stuff in the undergrad times, who knows? But Mark says, acknowledging that I may just be much more interested in this focused subject of study, and that I'm older and hope much wiser, I still find myself wondering if it's the training that's making the difference. And the reason for this is that I find my mind wandering whenever I am studying while not doing recess. And recess, he's talking about, is a Trainer Road ride, where it's just an easy, low-intensity spin. You could lock into erg mode on that and just like, you know, boom, take care of it. So Mark says, can you look into research on this topic and explain what's happening in my body while doing low intensity exercise that could potentially improve my information retention? We've covered in the past this topic in terms of what happens in your body and how you're signaling certain portions of your body to be aware. And as a result, that can help. But there's a really interesting study that just came out. It's a 2023 study. From Venezia and colleagues. And this is really cool. I want to read, basically, I'm just going to kind of like give you the cliff notes from this, but I'll link to this study down below so you can see it. So effectively what they did is they had 72 participants and they had them go through this test, this memory test, where they looked at 90 images and they were shown for 3 seconds each, followed by a 3 to 4 second break between the images. And then what they did is they split them up into groups and they had a exercise before group, an exercise after group, and then a control group that did no exercise whatsoever. And the exercise they did was a 24-minute hard cycling exercise. And looking at the RPE scale, it looks like they were supposed to ride around threshold for 20 minutes with a 2-minute warm-up and a 2-minute cool-down on either side. So pretty hard effort. And remember, they gave them this test where they looked at those 90 images for 3 seconds each, and then they had a group then go through and they had them either exercise before that or exercise after that or do no exercise. Then they did a follow-up test with them where they had them look at 180 images. So they doubled the amount of images. They were shown them for 3 seconds with those 3 to 4 second breaks. But during this test, they had to ask which images they saw in the previous test. And the interesting thing is that, and they noted this, across the board with the subjects, they saw a substantial increase in the memory recall of the people that did the hard exercise after that first memory test. So basically, you study something, then you exercise really hard. It can help improve memory retention. And the researchers said, we have no clue why this is the case, because they looked at the people that exercised before and they had no significant improvement compared to the control groups. And this is around 25 people in each group. So it's a decent size. It's not like we're dealing with a handful of people in each. But it's pretty interesting to see that doing studying and then exercising right after, and it's right after in this case, effectively the same, has this huge impact on your ability to, or potentially a huge impact on being able to retain information.
I feel like it's you're exercising without any music or anything, and like your brain just has something to think about, right? So you kind of think about those things that you saw. And also, Mark, maybe ADHD of like, if you are interested in, like you said, those business material, business focus, like case studies, and now you actually understand it too more. I remember in college, I did not get good grades at all until I found information systems, which was the thing that I was I liked it and I was hyper focused and I got straight A's. I was interested in it so I could, I wanted to do the stuff. I'd pay attention to class. I'd go to class. And same thing I've also had the same thing too of reading studies about business when I was in college, which I was interested in. But now when I look at them, I can I pick them apart and I see everything and I think I know the answer. And it's because I have that experience. It's so much easier to understand. Same thing like someone listening to this podcast who has no cycling experience versus someone who does. Imagine how your brain would drift if you didn't know anything where to the FTP and VO2 and all that sort of thing. Cyclocross, it'd be really hard to pay attention. Where if you have a lot of experience, it'd be good. I mean, you it is good. If you love, just leave it at that.
Yeah.
5 stars, yeah. Everyone.
Well done. The way I'm thinking on this one too, I always need to be fidgeting, physically doing something in order for my mind to be able to focus on a subject. It's funny. That's how my mom is too. It's how I've been.
It's called stimming.
Moving. Yeah. A stimming.
With ADHD. Yeah. Stimming, stimulation. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's a common thing with ADHD in particular, right, Nate?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I anything that I can fidget with, I'll just have a Rubik's cube and I'm not solving it or anything, but I'm just spinning it around in my fingers while I'm thinking through something or I'm tapping. I'm always doing something. And that process of pedaling sometimes, that metronomic effort, it passes me into almost a trance state a lot of the time. If I'm doing my easier workouts, that's when I get clarity. That's when I remember everything that I forgot to write down in my notes. That's when I can have clarity on my calendar and I can know what's going on the next day, all that stuff. That's when I get the most clarity that I get. So to Nate's point, there's probably a lot of different reasons behind it, but at the very least, it seems like this pairing of exercise and memory recall, there is actually scientific evidence in terms of experiments to back up that it does work. In terms of why exactly, man, there's a lot going on.
It helps too with your, this isn't related to Mark, but the decline, cognitive function decline as you age, people who exercise don't have as big a decline. So Everyone here is doing amazing. There's so many things that cycling helps and exercise in general in your life. So everyone should applaud themselves, especially when you're upset that you skipped your Thursday threshold workout and you're hard on yourself, but you're really ahead of 99.99% of all humans. If you were to compare that which you shouldn't, but if you did, in terms of health outcome and, the benefit that you're doing to your body.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's huge. Nate, sorry. One quick thing on that note, I saw a study the other day that was looking at, I can't remember if it was dementia or Alzheimer's patients, but it was looking at them and then it was having them do choreographed dance, classes. And it was showing that when they were doing the choreographed dance classes where they had movement paired with some sort of recall of a pattern or instruction that they were following, that it actually slowed the progression of symptoms for those people. And in some cases reversed for some subjects, some aspects of the symptoms that they were having. And that's a big thing that I think about. I wonder, even with structured training, of just knowing that all right, I have this workout and I'm supposed to follow this workout and I'm going to have 6 VO2 intervals. And those VO2 intervals are going to be float sets, like you talked about before, 15 seconds on, all those sort of things connecting in those different parts of your brain and your body. It's cool to see that it's beneficial for us in a lot of different ways. So exciting stuff.
Completely agree.
Yeah. If you've listened to this, thanks so much. We appreciate all of you. You're awesome. You can give this video a thumbs up on YouTube. You can share it with different people. And that would just mean the world to us. We don't charge for this podcast. We don't do anything like that. It would just be super helpful for us. So sign up for Trainer Road. Go to it. If you haven't yet, you're going to have your fastest season. I'm pretty darn comfortable on saying that. We even have a 30-day money back guarantee. If you don't feel it's making you faster, we'll give you your money back. So go sign up for it. Give it a shot. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.